Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soci.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soci. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. And once again, ladies and gentlemen, Film Sociology turns into sort of stage sociology. Indie Bard Fest is happening next week. It's running the 17th through the 27th. You can go to indiebardfest.com for tickets and information. Lear Shadow, The Tempest, a youth production of The Tempest, Hamlet and Henry IV Part 1 are all their shows this year. And full disclosure, yours truly is playing Falstaff. Explains a lot. But we're going to have a roundtable discussion with some of the members of Indie Bard Fest. But first, a little chat with Brian Ellerding, who is the author of Lear Shadow. He also did the stage version and also adapted it and directed it for the screen. And Lear Shadow was one of the plays of Indie Bard Fest. So here's my chat with Brian about the play and Shakespeare and relationships and some good marketing ideas, some by him, some by me. Brian, to start out with, what is your personal history with the play King Lear?
Ooh, that's a great question.
That's why I asked.
you're doing great so far. Fantastic interview. I have an admission to make, which is that I actually came to love Shakespeare very late in my life. Very late. I was in my late 20s, and I'd already been an actor for many years. And then, as a matter of fact, I'd already toured the country with Shakespeare's As You Like It. And even though I had been performing it, I didn't really love it. I hadn't found my way in to the love of Shakespeare yet. So it wasn't until fairly recently that I started playing with King Lear. And the way it got started was I had been doing a lot of very sad plays recently. And I wanted to see if I could take a sad play and make it uplifting somehow. And Lear is one of Shakespeare's absolutely most devastating plays. And it seemed like an interesting challenge to take such a sad ending of King Lear and see if there's some redemption in it. And that's how the idea of Lear's Shadow got started.
Okay, at first when you said you did a lot of sad plays, I went, oh, you're going to cleanse your palate with King Lear?
Yeah, I'm a sick person, Matthew. King Lear was, even in Shakespeare's time, a shockingly sad play, because the original story of King Lear is that everybody lives in the end. All the good guys live, and they beat the bad guys. So when Shakespeare's contemporaries saw his version of King Lear, it was even all the more devastating. So I thought, why not take the saddest play and see if we can find something that's a bit heartwarming. It's still not like an uproarious comedy, Lear Shadow, but it finds the hope on the other side of grief.
Okay. Well, so for the audience, what is the storyline on Lear Shadow?
It is the story of a family and their friend recovering from a tragedy, and the way they find their way out of this grief is through King Lear. It's an actor and a director from this company who have just suffered a loss that you don't know what it is at the beginning of the play, and they work their way through it by acting out and arguing about King Lear. And what I love about the way Glenn Dobbs has cast this particular iteration of the show is that the director, who ends up acting a lot of the King Lear lines, is a woman. She's this venerable actor from the Indianapolis area named Nan. And boy, is she a powerhouse.
I've heard that.
And I love, I love the idea of this powerful woman finding her footing in King Lear and having Shakespeare's text help her move through her problem. I don't want to say too much about it.
Of course,
the story is a drama, and it's a story of love and family and friendship. But it actually takes the shape of a mystery. So it's hard to talk about it without giving things away.
No, I understand.
Some revelations in the end. Yeah.
I guess I'm also intrigued with not just the connection between the characters you're saying, and not to say that it's running parallel to Lear, but that dynamic. Well, okay. Well, I stepped in it, but the connection between family. I mean, part of the reason why we're still doing Shakespeare after hundreds of years is because it's characters and behavior that we're still doing to this day.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I love the fact that there are new ways to find connection to Shakespeare. And frankly, I think the reason that I and a lot of people can sometimes take a long time to come around to loving Shakespeare is because sometimes it's done in such reverence of tradition that it does feel disconnected from anything that's relevant to us today. But if you find a group of actors who are dedicated to really making it raw and dangerous and surprising and playing the reality of what's going on for these characters, then it absolutely comes to life. And so what we do with Lear's Shadow is take this 400-plus-year-old text and find our way in. What's our version of this? And the added extra layer of Lear's Shadow is that the actors playing it in the play are actually playing other actors playing this Shakespearean text, and so there's this added layer of perspective, which actually makes the play great even for people who don't know anything about King Lear, because they discuss it, they argue about King Lear, and then they act it out. So even if you know nothing about the original show, you'll still enjoy it and you'll still know what's going on because the actors, the characters are actually talking about it. So they'll say, for example, okay, let's go to the scene where so-and-so does this, and then that the other person reacts by saying this. Okay, boom, and then they jump into it and they do it. It almost gives you all the exposition you need without being expositional.
And it's also the type of play that if you have siblings, you immediately have nicknames for your other siblings, thanks to King Lear.
Exactly. Exactly. You've got the sweet one. You've got the mean one. You've got the sexy one. Yeah, they're built into the play.
That is not a social media quiz, is it? Which King Lear daughter are you?
If it's not yet, it should be.
Probably
and
should
there's
be.
There's also Gloucester's sons. There's Edmund. There's
yeah.
Edgar, there's all sorts of great people you could be in this play. If this is you've given me an idea. This is going to be on our Facebook page.
Excellent.
At the end of the day.
Excellent. You're welcome. I also know from doing a little bit of research that you've done other adaptations of Shakespeare's work, like
right.
Rose Queen and Villains and Lovers. Can you elaborate a little more on those? Are these in the same ballpark as Lear's Shadow?
No, they're kind of different. It's
okay.
Funny that those are the way that I ended up writing Lear's Shadow. So I sort of backed into being a writer. I started the Ensemble Shakespeare Theater Company with a few actor friends because we were a little frustrated with the not the quality, but just the we longed for the days in college and right afterwards where we were doing Shakespeare and theater that was really juicy. And so we started this theater company, and somebody needed to get these pieces together. We weren't quite interested in just doing straight plays, Romeo and Juliet from beginning to end. We started doing funky adaptations or mashups or throwing together a few plays and seeing what the result was. And so I started writing the in-between stuff, just how do you get from this to this scene to this scene, not trying to fake Shakespeare, but giving just context. So having a narrator come out and speak to the audience, that type of thing. And so so Rose Queen is one where I just took four of Shakespeare's plays where Queen Margaret exists. Shakespeare loved the character of Queen Margaret, so he put her in as many plays as he could, even if it didn't make historical sense, he put her in plays.
Of course.
And we took those four plays and smashed them together and just followed Queen Margaret's story through those four plays. And that one I didn't have to write any sort of in-between stuff. But that was one of the ones that inspired me to do Lear's Shadow, because it is so sad. Everybody dies. Everybody suffers. It's just a bunch of misery in that. Another one that I'm very fond of is Shakespeare's Villains, where we took three of Shakespeare's most famous villains, Shylock from Merchant of Venice, Macbeth from Macbeth, and Tybalt from Romeo and Juliet, and just followed their stories, removed from the rest of the play. And when you take them in that context, they actually become their own protagonists, and it's easy to see how they make the choices they make.
So basically you did a Shakespearean Joker.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. Yeah. That's how I'm going to sell it from now on. You keep on giving me all these great ideas. Are you available to do consulting on marketing?
Because, as soon as I get done playing Falstaff, we'll talk.
You sound a little young to be a Falstaff, but
you haven't seen my girth. It's as I believe as Sir Larry said, it's called acting, dear boy.
Yes. Hey, look at you! All right, some Olivier quotes.
That's right.
Throw them out there.
These are your pledge dollars at work. And so I'm guessing Lovers is similar. It's not an orgy, right?
Lovers is not an orgy. That is a fair, yes, you are correct in that assessment. Lovers is the first one where I actually wrote lines for a narrator. And it's literally, that's just a fun romp through Shakespeare's love scenes. And there's a narrator saying, here's a love scene from this play. And then we acknowledge the fact that we are actors doing a show for you. And that actually does lend itself a little bit to being the antecedent to Lear's Shadow, in that we're acknowledging that this is a theatrical experience we're about to have. But for Lear's Shadow, when you walk into the theater, you're like a fly on a wall watching these theater artists talk their way through this material. Whereas Lovers, in Shakespeare's Lovers, literally the actors come out and just speak right at the audience.
So it's like a Shakespearean, like a Shakespearean cabaret.
If you will, it is a there's not much of a plot. It's just sort of here's some fun love here's some fun love scenes.
Yeah.
It was developed originally for a performance at a local botanical garden here in Los Angeles called Descanso Gardens, where we've done shows for the last 6 or 7 years, and it fit that location really well because it's just a beautiful garden, and so people come and they're not expecting to cry or lose their minds. So we're not going to do something like a full production of Rose Queen there, because mm-hmm. It's such a tragedy. Nobody wants to go to a tragedy in these beautiful gardens on an afternoon. So Shakespeare's Lovers was great for that.
Excellent. Have you seen on YouTube? There's a clip of what is called The Real Housewives of Shakespeare.
No, I haven't.
You have an assignment now. That's good.
Okay.
I guess also.
That's fine. Shakespeare.
Yeah. Great. I'm curious about how it was going from stage to screen for the adaptation of Lear's Shadow.
I'm really lucky in that the actors in the original production here in Pasadena were also fantastic TV and film actors. David Blue has been on a bunch of TV shows and a bunch of movies. Fred Cross has been in more TV shows than I can count. Katie Peabody graduated from USC with a degree in film. All three of the stars, just phenomenal actors. So we had already been rehearsing it. We'd been rehearsing the show. We actually shot the film during the run of the play.
Ooh.
So it was really easy. We shot the whole thing in a shockingly short amount of time because we were able to do 10-minute takes. We didn't have to stop and fix things because the actors were all so well rehearsed that we were able to just roll the camera and shoot for 10 minutes at a time. So we ended up with fantastic footage that at first we were just shooting it because we had all the actors and we had the capacity, but we very quickly realized that this was more than just for our own reels, that this mm-hmm. there was something here, and that's when we really called in the big guns. I pulled some favors from people I've been working with in the industry and have been fortunate enough to stay friends with. And so we got this tiny little indie film made, and it was a wonderful experience. So it translated really immediately because Lars, our DP, ended up getting to understand the play very well and shot it in such a way that you really feel that you are there, a fly on the wall, watching this happen in this rehearsal room. So it gives you the same experience, not the same experience, a similar experience to what a theater audience would have had and can have if they come to see Leader Shadow in Indianapolis.
Which is, of course, a part of Indie Bard Fest, indiebardfest.com,
yeah,
for all that. Okay, now I want to wrap things up with three Lear-inspired titles and see if you know, if you've seen them or if you know of them. Are you ready?
Ooh, okay. Yes, I'm ready.
Akira Kurosawa's Ron.
Of course, fantastic and so weird and so colorful and so violent. Holy smokes.
Yeah, that, he doesn't fool around on that one.
No, he sure doesn't.
That was my second Kurosawa film in the theater, and this is 1985, and I think, you know, computers were not quite able to take over yet, but I couldn't believe how many people were involved, and when the woman, I believe the woman won for best costume because she, I don't know if she didn't do it herself, it was darn close. I mean, you could see the extras as opposed to.
I'm gonna be
the old man on the front stoop, you know, with your CG extras and everything. I'm looking at you, Troy.
Yeah, no.
But it was
amazing. Isn't it like 3.5 hours long?
It didn't feel it.
Like
still doesn't feel like it.
Epic. It is an epic film.
Yeah.
Wow. And I understand how he has been an influence on Quentin Tarantino. After watching that movie, you get it. You get Kill Bill after seeing Ron.
And also the end of Throne of Blood. That's also not happening well for the guy who's not Macbeth.
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
Nobody's happy there.
No. Okay. Second one. King of Texas.
No, King of Texas. I don't know King of Texas.
Patrick Stewart. It's a TNT film where he is a land baron. And I believe two of the daughters are Marcia Gay Harden and Lauren Holly. So this was done, I think, in the early aughts.
Wow. No, I completely missed that.
Okay. So, I'm giving you stuff to watch over the weekend. This is fabulous.
I didn't expect to come out of this interview with homework, but I like it.
Okay. And then finally, a Thousand Acres.
Thousand Acres. I haven't even heard of that. What is that?
This was a novel that was later made into a film in the 90s. And it's American Farmland, and it's Jason Robards, and the daughters are Jessica Lange, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Ooh, wow, that sounds like a hell of a cast.
Yeah. So, and it's a little melodramatic and. They go down a path that isn't really addressed in the other Lears, and I don't know if they needed to, but they did anyway. So there's that. So anyway, so
there are so many great adaptations of Lear, and there's a line in Lear's Shadow, which is that critics call King Lear unactable. It is a really hard show to pull off. There's so many things that even today. People who get their PhDs in textual analysis of Shakespeare's works argue about why doesn't Edgar reveal himself to his father earlier? Why? I mean, there's so many funny decisions that people make in the play. It is a hard play to do.
Yeah.
And we kind of cheat in Lear's Shadow because we don't really do the whole play. We just talk about it and we get to do all the scenes that we love the most, which is kind of why I love it so much, because no matter what you feel about King Lear as a play itself, this show is not really about King Lear, strangely enough. It's about these three people and their connection. And King Lear is the environment in which they're solving their problems, and they're having it out with each other, and they're confronting their own inner demons. But King Lear is the tool they're using. It is more about them. It's more about these real people here in the room with you in the theater, dealing with each other and sparking love in each other than it is about anything else. And that's how we sort of cheat, but that's also sort of why it should be hopefully really fun for anybody who goes to see the play.
Absolutely. And if it makes more people want to find out more about King Lear, and or if it makes you feel better about your own upcoming Thanksgiving, you're going to be okay.
Exactly. I'm just here to make people feel better about their families, really. That's isn't that what all theater is about at the end of the day?
One would hope. So, or we'll do the King Lear meets August Osage County or something like that.
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
All right, well, Brian, I really, really appreciate your time. And, Lear Shadow is a part of Indie Bard Fest, indiebardfest.com. And, Brian, I will be in touch with you via social media for my new job.
Wonderful. Looking forward to it. And thank you for this wonderful interview.
All right, take care. That was author, director, and really good sport, Brian Ellerding. His show, Lear Shadow, is a part of Indie Bard Fest. You can go to indiebardfest.com for tickets and information. And... wow, the round robin. Who is Dorothy Parker and who's the rest of the vicious circle? That's who's in studio with me. So I'm gonna have my guests verbally introduce themselves and their purpose at Indie Bard Fest.
My name is Missy Rump, and I am playing Peyto in Henry IV.
My name is Nan Macy, and I'm playing Jackie in Lear's Shadow.
My name is Glenn Dobbs, and people tell me I not really have a purpose in this whole production. They remind me of that every day. But when I'm not reminded of that, I'm the producer of Bardfest.
And full disclosure, I'm playing Falstaff in Indie Bardfest. And Nan, no, Powerhouse.
Yes.
As we heard in the exactly. In the interview.
Yes.
We're going to get Nan a boxing robe that has Powerhouse encrusted in glitter or something on the back. So mm-hmm. She'll take on Jerry Cooney. It'll be a riveting match. So, all right.
I don't know who Jerry Cooney is.
It's a boxing reference.
Actually, I do, but my money's on Nan.
We were also supposed to have Brian Hartz in studio as a guest. He's playing Hamlet in Indie Bard Fest's production of Hamlet, but he could not be here. There was a scheduling conflict. However, that's never stopped me from playing the introduction of Brian Hartz.
It's called Inception.
So Brian doesn't even show up and he gets that intro.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he does.
Wait a minute. I thought I was the powerhouse.
You are
here.
A powerhouse. What, we'll get to what? You
my
want
my intro was Copacabana.
Yeah. Yes.
Do you want the theme from 2001? You'll be like Ric Flair.
Oh, that'd be great.
That'd be good.
Elvis. Yeah.
I don't know who that is either, but I want the intro.
You don't know who Elvis Presley was?
Elvis Presley.
No, she didn't know who Ric Flair is.
You know the theme to 2001, don't you?
I do that,
yeah.
Yes. But
that's
I
awesome.
Know who
well,
we, Rick all right,
Nan, I'm going to come up with some form. Yeah,
Russ.
I'm going to come up with some form of music for you, and we'll work on that. So,
okay.
But no. You just said Copacabana.
Copacabana.
I get the. Meanwhile, I get a recording of a Falstaff beer commercial done by Cream in 1968.
That's
so.
Perfect.
Cream is good.
Oh, it's,
ooh, Ginger Baker just died.
Yeah, he did. He did. We're gonna talk about that in a little bit. We'll get to that. So. So I guess I want to start with Glenn.
Yes.
Because I'm catching him off guard.
Yes.
So when the season was getting developed, I know there's a youth production, of course, we mentioned
right.
the Tempest, but usually a comedy and or a tragedy. There's a history play thrown in, and of course there's an original script that has Shakespeare tendencies. I guess what is the Thunderdome like meeting to get the titles picked for this particular season?
Before or after the beer?
Before.
No, what we try to do is we try to approach local artists, local people that are skilled in directing shows, and we go to them and we try to say what's your passion project? What's a show that you would like to see done? Nan has mentioned some shows to me before that are coming up next year. There are others that are there. You have a passion for Midsummer Night's Dream.
I mentioned a Midsummer Night's Dream set in Louisiana.
Yeah, and so. Exactly. And so what we do is I meet with a director and I talk to them and kind of get a sense of what their particular vision is. And we talk about the theater space that we're in and what we're trying to accomplish with that. And then from that show, I go to the next one. If the guy says, I also want to do Midsummer Night's Dream, then we have to start making some edits and cuts. But we try to build a diverse thing. We try to build something that's an obvious crowd pleaser like Midsummer Night's Dream. And we also try to provide some diverse projects like Lear Shadow, which is not something you would normally get an opportunity to see, but it's incredibly exciting that we have this opportunity for you to come and see it and see something brand new that has won awards and is now a feature film, et cetera.
That's right. The last time I saw you on stage, and we're in a radio station, it's fine. You were in Macbeth, and you took my phone. You took my phone for longer than the novelty really needed to be. But
did I do that?
Yeah, you did.
Did what's her name?
No, you did. You did.
No, I did.
I was
that.
With Monica Hartz, and
yes.
and there
yeah,
was that.
That.
Yeah, I know, because we're married, but not to each other. hi, Brian. Hi, Monica. But no, there was that moment. Okay, it's cute. Give me
it's
my
not
phone
cute
back.
Anymore.
No, it's like the show's going to start soon, and eventually you did. So,
yeah.
it reminded me of the Onion article. The headline just reads, "Oh bleep, actors are coming off the stage." You know those members of the audience. It's like when I dragged my lovely daughter to see Godspell, and when the cast came out at Footlight to do Day by Day for 5 minutes up the aisles, and then she's like,
don't
go near me.
Get him away from me. I don't know these people.
But guess what, folks? This year at Indie Bar, we're in your face venues, really.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
How's it been working on Lear Shadow?
Oh, what a lovely play. What a lovely play. It's been really a joy. And an incredible challenge.
Yeah.
I heard the author say that one of the lines in the show is, well, all the critics say it's unactable, and it pretty much is. Lear is really hard.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. So.
It's not hard to understand, though. What's hard about it is the challenge for the actor of having to go from 0 to 60 and just a line or two. It's an incredibly difficult, physically challenging, mentally and emotionally challenging thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But the words, oh my goodness, the words.
They're
beautiful. And it's just some of the most powerful stuff that Shakespeare ever wrote. But it should be important to remember that this isn't King Lear. This is a story that involves aspects of King Lear. This is a story about modern people, three people that are thrust into an extraordinary situation. There is a really significant thing that happens in their lives, and what they have to do to try to figure that out is where the story goes. And some of the arc of the story of the real folks parallels the story of Lear. And so they use that as a device to help explain and work through this very, very difficult situation. And you get to see people like Nan play different characters, Tom playing what, 5-6 characters, it seems like.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all right there in front of you under just normal lighting. It's incredible.
This is the first time really that I have come close to understanding Lear.
Exactly.
Because of the modern day story, there's a lot of give and take between the two modern characters
That's right.
The stage,
yeah.
And you see the parallel between Lear's situation and the character Jackie that I play,
right.
And it really illuminates, to me, the character of Lear.
And, you know, one of the things I think the author would agree is there are moments in the traditional play King Lear that are just some of the most electric and powerful moments in the entire Shakespeare canon. And what you are fortunate enough to be able to do is sort of play the greatest hits. It's sort of be able to take those electric moments and be able to string them all together in a rapid series of sequences that allows you to just enjoy this. It's like Shakespeare Led Zeppelin. It's just amazing. You know, it really is. I'm sorry, I'm getting into music, aren't
I? No, that's I'm just coming up with ideas now. So Yeah, I'm working on that. So I also see you've been bulking up your arms. You know,
I have. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I'm powerhouse.
Yes, that's right. As we've always learned, make sure your Cordelia is light. So.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, fortunately, the young lady who is playing our Cordelia is magnificent.
Oh, my goodness, yes. Mm-hmm. Morgan Morton.
She's unbelievably tender and beautiful and generous on stage. These two people I'm working with are the most generous actors.
Excellent.
It's really been fun.
It's very absorbing, mm-hmm. very fast-paced. Mm-hmm. And the twist at the end, oh, my goodness.
That they're made out of people?
No.
Rosebud is a sled?
No.
They were dead all along?
No. You wake up and it's all a dream.
Nana's Kaiser Soze?
Yeah. Or I'll test you. It's all in a snowball. Remember that one?
Rosebud. Yeah.
No.
Oh, St. Elsewhere.
St. Elsewhere.
Yep.
No.
And actually, everybody did it.
That's right. Everybody did it. That's right.
There. No, we've ruined a lot of endings for a lot of people. How
yes.
you doing?
Yeah.
But you can't ruin this ending because the ending is so powerful and so extraordinary.
You know, I've now been working with this show for 5-6 weeks. And I'm telling you, every time that ending happens, it catches me every single time.
There you go,
it
folks.
It is just, it's stunning what happens. And your jaw just drops and you're left with this incredibly powerful moment. It's also a feature film on iTunes. You can find it now. And I think people will come, will be able, you don't need to know about King Lear to be able to come and enjoy it.
It sounds like it's going to be a really good gateway
to
King Lear. Yeah,
absolutely.
So,
speaking of gateway drugs, let's talk about Falstaff.
Do we have to? No, actually, before we get into that, I do want to bring up Hamlet since Brian could not be here. And what is we're going to discuss this a little
it's
bit
not
in
a very
the
well-known play.
In the film port. Yeah, it's so long and
not
it's
very well known.
So indecisive. Yeah. I'm kidding, guys. You know what we mean.
Seven people die while he's being indecisive.
He's praying, whatever. No. But actually, we're going to get into that when we get into the film portion of the film show. But what's going to be fun about this, and I tell people about Shakespeare, when you see Shakespeare, it's this version is going to be different than that version. It's going to be different than this version. This is going to be the third production of Hamlet I've seen since the summer.
Right.
And the last two were considerably different from each other, and this one will be completely different from those other ones.
Yeah, and one of the things I think if Brian were here, he would tell you.
First off, he'd say, make the intro longer.
Yeah.
He's not a fan of Hans Zimmer, and that's why he has that intro.
Brian, I think it's fair to say that Brian Hartz is probably one of the most talented actors with verse that's currently working in the city. He can handle 6-7 page monologues and make them sparkling and interesting and engaging like no one else I've ever been able to see it. But what's different about this Hamlet is the fact that it's so close. I mean, you're not sitting far away in a dark theater. I mean, you're right there.
Yep.
And the entire story unfolds for you right there. So it makes it so much more accessible and real and just the story just really comes alive. And it is it's the greatest story ever written. So, you know, there you are. I'll take that on with anybody else who wants to call in the radio show. Oh, look, we have people calling in.
No, we didn't. It's not that. I want to continue to work here. That might be why we don't take calls. So I will. There was that one time I berated.
Oh, look, there's that nasty tweet on Twitter now.
sometime later, I'll tell you the time I actually berated a caller on No Limits about a film. But apologize would indicate I did something wrong.
Copacabana.
I was not wrong. No, it wasn't that. It was something else that it felt like a sports radio talk show moment, and it was here at NPR. So, but anyway, so this will be, and Doug Powers is directing Hamlet.
Can I just
please Powerhouse?
I shall.
yes, champ.
Okay.
I am not calling you Powerhouse. Or not doing it. So
I refuse to take any of your notes unless
you call
you
Powerhouse.
Oh,
now
that's
we're
right.
in the Val Kilmer portion of the show. You will only address me as Powerhouse.
You will address me as Powerhouse. So,
oh my god.
I wanted to say, speaking of Powerhouse,
yes.
The fight sequences I have been privileged to see are scary. They are extraordinary. These are athletic people, and they
In Lear
are,
Shadow?
Shadow.
Man, they hurl words like daggers,
like
which sounds very
strange.
No,
right
in Hamlet,
heart.
In Hamlet, and in Henry IV.
Hamlet, yeah. You dork! They're in Hamlet.
So I'm dork. She's powerhouse, and I'm now dork.
Hair dork.
Hair dork.
H-E-R-R.
I get to stab lots of things.
Missy is the most popular one. Missy's going to get the most applause from anybody.
Oh,
not
wow.
Even forget Hal and the fat guy. No. And no, they're going to love Pato. They're going to love Pato.
I want to see you stabbing things.
She's a quiet lady with a big sword. And yeah.
No, just before we go too far, that I really want to echo what Nan said. I mean, the fight scene in Hamlet is just terrific, and it's a classic fencing kind of scene, and they've got a terrific fight choreographer. And also in Henry IV, we have, I think, 6 battles, including
27 people on stage
at the same time, all swinging long swords, and it's a thrilling show. And there's death here and there, and in fact,
and everywhere.
One fellow we kill so many times, but we need the extra soldier. He keeps coming back.
How many times do we kill poor Eli? 6, 7? Yeah.
Not enough. No, it reminded me. There's a wonderful moment in the film Splash. And that's Daryl Hannah's a mermaid and living with Tom Hanks. And he comes home from work and she's crying watching the television. And he's like, what's wrong? And she's like, this is the saddest thing I've ever seen. And he looks at the TV and goes, it's Bonanza. And then he explains, that guy, when the TV show's over, he's just acting. And he'll get up and he'll be fine and he'll go die on another show. You know, that sort of thing. So
it's actually kind of funny.
Yeah, it's actually kind of funny. So yeah, that's what it reminds me of. Like, we haven't killed him enough. And I assure you our fight choreographer, the fight scenes sound great. I don't see any of them. I'm too busy fainting and other things. If you haven't seen Henry IV, I can't give away that big plot twist if you can't figure that out. But yeah, there's a lot of people on stage.
Henry IV is like fighting and drinking.
Yes.
A lot, yes.
So, and welcome to Film Sociology, a film talk.
No, but what's great about, no, this is the thing about Henry IV, and it's really, really great, is Henry IV was the original prototype of the idea of, we talk about the royalty, but we also talk about the people downstairs.
Yeah.
That there is the world of the royals and the kings, but there's also the world of the peasants and the barkeep. And it is, as one writer put it, the correspondence between these two worlds is what makes it interesting. Because its predecessor, Richard II, was all about royalty.
Yeah.
And you never got to see what happened to the other people. So characters of Falstaff, Pato, Bardolph, and several of them that are in the show are all just regular Joes there in the bar.
The Cheers portion of Henry IV.
Yeah, exactly. And people who are watching the show, and back then when they watched the show, really would identify with that, really would say, well, the king's making the decision to go to war. Well, how does that affect me? You know, and what does that happen with there? So that's what's so fun about it. And people watch it and say, well, I've seen that before. No, you haven't. Shakespeare invented that. You know, and when we watch things like Downton Abbey today, the upstairs, downstairs, that's a Shakespearean invention of watching both worlds interact at the same time.
So, Glenn, would the aristocracy who watched these also, I mean, there were those people in the audience.
They would perform for the king and queen.
You would perform for the king and queen in the court and so forth. Was that interesting to them, or a revelation to them?
Were pearls clutched?
Yeah.
Were they clutching their ruffs?
No, they were, but you know, I can't possibly get in the mind of what they were at the time, but you know, they lived in a world where they never interacted with that, and so that would be almost like going to the zoo for them. You know, it would be like, oh, this is what these people do, you know, type of thing.
Right.
What was scary about the fact is that Shakespeare, although he had some money and he had some education, the best of knowledge that we have, he wrote about palace intrigue as if he was an insider.
Yeah.
That he knew about all the different little ins and outs about the way things were. And he also would write about the bar and Falstaff and common people. There's a reason we still do his plays 400 years later, because they are so well crafted. They're so interesting. They have so
many. And well observed.
And they just are. And I think when you go and see it done well, and we do it well, and when you go see it done well, it's incredibly entertaining. As I said when we were doing another media appearance earlier this week, he was a populist. he would write popular entertainment. Mm-hmm. And the Henry plays were enormously popular. Mm-hmm. They were just crazy crowd pleasers because the crowd would sit there and say, well, I get to see what the king is like behind closed doors, mm-hmm. you know, type mm-hmm. of thing.
I wonder what the king is doing tonight.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly.
Well, why? Since you started on it, Glenn, since I think Henry IV is probably the least known of the three, what is the plot for Henry IV Part 1? Because nobody likes Part 2.
Nobody likes Part 2.
You heard me ragging on Jurassic Park 6, but you will do that punchline on Part 2.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
It's on the shirt.
It's on the shirt.
It's on the shirt.
Well,
it's in the curtain speech.
Do you want to tell the story of Henry IV? Or do you feel comfortable doing it? Let me do that.
I know my part in Henry okay. IV, so let me go right ahead.
Yeah, we're learning our stuff. Yeah.
Henry IV is part of a cycle of plays that are sometimes called the Henriad. And the reason it's called that is English had several kings named Henry. And so they would name themselves after each other over and over and over again. And they all belonged to the family of the Plantagenets. And so prior to Henry IV, there was a king named Richard II. And Richard II got overthrown by Henry IV, but deposed in kind of a questionable manner. And although there was some legitimacy to it, there was also a lot of things that weren't legitimate. So he comes to the throne with the idea that he doesn't really deserve to be at the throne. So as a result of that, since he started this particular precedent, other nobles in the area, like Hotspur and Northumberland and Vernon and some of the other nobles in the area, say, well, if he can overthrow a king, why can't we overthrow a king? Mm-hmm. And so his reign is constantly dealing with rebellion, constantly dealing with people trying to overthrow him. Now, what makes it interesting is his son, who is called Hal in the play, would go on to become Henry V. Those of you that remember in your line of work, the film Henry V by Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah, that upstart young Ken.
Yeah, Henry V was considered by most people to be the most noble, greatest English king that ever lived.
But first he went through a Bush twin sisters phase by hanging out in bars.
He was hanging out in bars and brothels and prostitutes and was everything that a crown prince should not be. And that was what was so remarkable about it, because the people that were watching would go, well, that's what he did before he became king. Mm-hmm. And so you get to watch him as he grows into this role of being this messianic king, and you get to watch the king try to deal with the consequences and the guilt associated with his rebellion. Fun fact, real Henry IV. He said, well, I've overthrown the king. I need to make up for my sin, so I will go and die in Jerusalem. He did die in Jerusalem. He died in the Jerusalem room in Westminster Abbey.
Wow.
And that room was built by Richard II, his predecessor. So when he's laying on the bed in front of the fireplace, as he's looking up at the rafters above, it says R2 at the rafters above. And it's a crazy karma that actually occurred. With it. And one other thing, I'm sorry, I'm doing too much on the mic here, but
that's all right.
One other thing, the character of Falstaff, who is considered in the canon of Shakespeare one of his greatest creations, the wit, the wisdom, the lord, the king of vice. Everybody loves Falstaff because Falstaff is the life of the party.
That sounds like a sitcom.
Yeah,
that
means, king of vice.
That means Michelle's my hot, very smart sitcom wife.
There you go.
Yeah. Well,
so,
future
so this
Mrs.
is typecasting.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But that character, everybody, if you say Falstaff to people, even not a Shakespeare person,
Norm.
Most people know who Falstaff is. This is where Falstaff first appears and does some of his greatest silliness is in Henry IV,
yeah.
Type of thing. So it's a great play. It's called The Perfect History Play. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. There's fighting, there's loving, there's laughing, there's drinking, and there's a lot of fart jokes.
I'm trying on command. I'm cue. I'm trying.
Yeah, exactly.
And Missy with a giant sword.
And Missy with a giant sword. That's the best part of the show.
That's what I'm coming to see.
Yeah,
I'm coming to see
the giant sword.
This sweet woman that I know with a giant sword.
Oh my God, she has a claymore and she does,
yeah. You know. Actually, before we so have you told Abdul where he's dying?
Oh yeah, yeah. I told him.
Yeah,
I told him
in Berwyn,
and he said in that very tender voice of Abdul, he goes, "Sweet." totally cool. As I'll do that.
We've had regular guests on the show. Of course, Brian Hartz is one. Also, full disclosure, regular film sociology guest Abdul-Hakim Shabazz is playing Henry IV.
You've got to come see him do this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're doing a show together. You've been warned. Yeah. You're very afraid. Now back to Missy. How are you, dear?
I'm fantastic.
So how's the experience been for you? Don't mind him. He's not paying attention.
It's always so trying when I work with Glenn. He's just such a pain. No.
I'm making notes.
Glenn's fantastic. I'm so honored to be part of this cast and to be able to come back and work with Glenn again. For some crazy reason, he thinks I can do comedy. And I haven't decided yet if it's because I actually might know what I'm doing or if it's just the fact that I am really not afraid to look like a complete idiot in front of people I don't know. Yeah.
Missy's phenomenally talented. Yeah.
I have had so much fun getting to know, all you guys.
See, social media for good, not for evil.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, I've briefly worked with you back in Richard, and so it's been fantastic getting to know you. Eli, I've never worked with before.
That's the one who dies nine times.
He dies 1,200 times.
He's like my story. He dies 11 times, actually.
And then,
he started dying twice, and now he's to 11. So.
The third member of our Three Stooges little gang is Bardoff, who is J.B. Scoble. And I don't know where he came from, but he's fantastic, too.
America's Most Wanted.
Was that it? Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Way to blow his cover.
Part of his witness relocation program. Yeah.
But, after you've been in the Shakespeare scene for a little while, and I've not been in it nearly as long as some of these other folks have, but
you just called us old.
I didn't miss that. That was not unnoticed.
Vintage, dear.
Venerable. Yes. Venerable.
Venerable with a B.
But you start to work with a lot of the same people over and over again and just get to know them better and more. And so it's been a lot of fun getting to know new folks this time. And like I said, I haven't seen JB around. I'm not sure where he came from or how we found him, but he's fantastic.
I love you. Like, he's a stray dog.
He's an alien from outer space.
I met JB.
I found this actor. Can we keep him?
I met JB doing a Christmas play together with him and got to know him a little bit. And,
wait, what was the Christmas play? You're not superstitious about saying Christmas plays, are you? Hi.
No,
well, I'm going to poke the hornet's nest a little more.
Oh, goodness.
Christmas Carol, Nightmare on 34th Street. Nightmare on 34th
Street. We go.
Miracle on 34th Street.
No, the radio play.
It's a Wonderful Life.
Wonderful Life. Yeah.
Okay, he's fantastic.
Great story. Wonderful Life. So I'm cast as Uncle Billy.
Oh, yes.
I'm cast as Uncle Billy.
One of the dumbest characters because he loses all the money.
I know. And so I looked at the original movie and I go, I'm too young to play Uncle Billy. And so I looked up the actor's age at the time he was filming. He's 2 years younger than I am.
That's okay. Apparently your Falstaff is nimble. So
Yeah. No, I'm but he gonna... was he was in that. And then I had the pleasure of seeing him in the lead role of Streetcar Named Desire.
Oh, okay.
And as comedic and as funny as he is in that, he was devastating in that play. Yeah. He was
amazing. Who did he play?
He played Marlon Brando. He played Stanley?
Stanley.
Wow.
And I'm telling
you...
I am telling you, it was mesmerizing.
Where was this?
This was at the Cat. It was up part of Carmel, the Community Players.
No way!
And it was a very good production, and they did a very fine job. And I felt so bad because Bardolph is a medium-sized role, and he did that role, which is like a Hamlet, type of thing. I said, I can't beat that role when I offered him the part.
Mm-hmm.
And it was huge. He was fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the intensity that he is in the comedy with Bardolph, he was just the complete other way around. And the Streetcar Named Desire, of course, is not like the movie, so Stanley is more menacing in that. And the sweet, lovable JB that we have.
You can understand what he's saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, this shall not pass.
I'm sorry. That's an easy punchline on Mr. Brando's work, as my wife affectionately calls him Mr. Mumbles.
Yeah. Oh. So, but that's where he came from. And so then we did another show together. We did the Scottish play up in Noblesville.
You can say Macbeth. You're in a radio station.
Folks, I just want to be on the record here now that if we have anything happen in this
right.
play, it is directly the result of Mr. Matthew
Soucy.
You can reach him at WFYI. Yeah. He likes to get letters, and he likes to get notes on Twitter.
I've also done plays that I've directed and said the word, and absolutely nothing happened.
That's because you're evil.
Yes.
You have no idea. All right, all right. So, wow, that's – so. Okay, I have to – I also directed – the radio version of It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
I got to direct it three times at Anderson University and one time in Richmond. And I will tell this little piece of theatrical Babylon story because it's somebody that we all know. First time I did it in December of 2011 at Anderson University, I had a young actor named Adam Tran as –
I'm sorry. Who?
Yeah, I know this kid. this young upstart kid, and I know he's going to be sick of me telling the story, but I don't care. But he was Clarence, and also got to do a myriad of other voices and things, so he got to stretch his muscles there. And we do the first read through, and he reads Clarence like Russell Brand.
And
I thought, okay, college kids, there, that's cute. And then we read it the second night, and he did it again. And then my brain went, oh, he's serious. So I pulled him aside, and I said, Adam, you can keep Clarence English, but he can't have had anything to do with Katy Perry. And that was our compromise, and Clarence became English. So,
wow.
Yeah. But he got to do a myriad of voices. He got to do his Irish accent, and he got to do his Southern, and, you know, anytime he can, you know, play 15 different roles. So anyway. So in theater, we tell old stories. And Adam, thank you for making it an old theater story. it has been a lot of fun working on Bard. Like I said, the fight scenes sound great. I can't tell you what they look like. And by the way, if you want romance, wait till you see the end of Henry IV. And if you're a fan of Matt Anderson,
absolutely.
You're going to.
Absolutely.
Oh my goodness.
I haven't seen it, but now I will.
Yeah, well, yeah. We're talking about stuff we're not going to give away. Yeah.
We have a
body scene.
Yes, that's true.
Body.
One of the characters sings in Welsh.
We got some production value.
We have some really pretty stuff. We've got music. We've got everything in the show. It's a hilarious show. So I think you'll enjoy it.
And then there's like 57 kids doing The Tempest.
Yeah.
Oh, I should mention that. Yes. I really should mention that. The Tempest is directed by Dr. Kathy Phipps, part of the Agape Performing Arts Company. This is their second appearance at Bardfest. Now, everybody goes to a youth show, and there's always that one kid that just is the standout, and everyone else is kind of dragged along by that one kid. That's not the case here. What you have is that one kid multiplied times 50 kids. They're all
right.
That good. And as I visited their rehearsals and as I've spent some time with this group, this is not a kid show. This is a fully fleshed adult show.
Grown-up show. Please don't say adult show. That sounds like Boogie Nights.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Okay.
We learned this very, very early on when my lovely daughter would say, the first time she said, I watch adult movies with my parents. No. You watch grown-up movies with your parents because we don't want CPS coming over. So, no, grown-up. I'm sorry.
That's the thing, though. But a lot of people think of youth production, they think, well, it's going to be watered down. It's going to be... And then next year, they're going to do a very grown-up play.
Yeah, they are. I'm kind of jealous because I had also pitched it. And IndieBardFest.com for all the information. So you can see 300, but you see about 50 kids, and then you get to see a sword battle royal, and then you see a guy with a skull, and then you see the real bloodshed in Lear Shadow because that's
where Powerhouse
that's
is.
Right.
That's where Powerhouse is.
That's right.
All right, so that is IndieBardFest.com for all the ticket information. We'll get into some more Shakespeare in a little bit, but we've been running almost an hour. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org, and I'm here with a round table. It's like a Vanity Fair, only not.
Wait a minute. I think you might have hit the nail on the head there.
What, that it's not Vanity Fair?
There might be some vanity here.
I know the song is about me. Okay. So just a reminder, yeah, opening in theaters, you have Who Asked for the Addams Family Animated? That's out there. The collaboration between two Will Smiths and Ang Lee is out there.
Is that any good?
Gemini Man? I've been in rehearsal. I wasn't able to attend the screening.
I'm sorry, where were you the last few nights?
Wow. Sweating, literally and figuratively, in my fat suit and in getting stuff memorized. Anyway, but no, that's opening. Yeah, we'll get to that in a little bit. I do want to mention, before we get into the film that opened last week, over at IU Cinema. Now, this is before Bard Fest goes up, but Saturday at 4:00, Rosine Bacham, the director, is going to be present for the 2018 film Chez Jolie Coiffeur, pardon my French. And then Robert Greene will be at IU 7:00 on October 12th with film Bisbee 17. Sunday the 13th at 1:00 at Eternity's Gate and Small Island at 4:00. Murmurs and Documenteur on Monday the 14th at 7:00. Speedy, the 1928 silent film with musical accompaniment, will be happening on Thursday the 17th. And the Alloy Orchestra will be at IU Cinema at 4:00 on October 18th, along with Gallery of Monsters at 7:00. That is all happening at IU Cinema. Now, at Midnight Madness at Keystone Arts, they are up and running. Mark your calendars. You could actually go see Indie Bard Fest and go to a midnight movie.
Not with Hamlet.
Oh.
Wow, you had to put that in there. It's not as long as Sir Ken's version, which is the entire play.
I'm just joking.
And by the way, got to see Ken Branagh's Hamlet in a movie theater in Chicago. It is the only time I ever purchased movie tickets over the phone. And to borrow a quip from Dennis Miller, I'm not on the phone that long with friends contemplating suicide.
Oh, my gosh.
And there were rock concerts easier to get into than this film. People were jumping over seats and claiming them. And the only thing missing were beach balls and lighters when the screen went lit. But anyway, you can... Okay, maybe if you speed out of Hamlet, you can go to a midnight movie. October 18th and 19th at Keystone Arts, the original 1974 Tobey Hooper, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. August 25th and 26th, John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness. And November 8th and 9th, with Tommy Wiseau in person, The Room will be playing at midnight at Keystone Arts.
Wow.
Which means, yes, that means that week before, I will replay my classic interview with Tommy Wiseau here on Film Sociology.
I should stress, all of the plays that we're doing are edited. They all have very
yes.
nice run times. And I'm just joking about the Hamlet
yes.
thing. It's a nice, brisk pace.
There you go.
It's a great show.
All right. We now move over, and we are tough Midwesterners because it's October and the drive-ins are still open. Do you remember the last time you attended a drive-in movie?
Yes, I do.
What did you see?
Valley of the Guanji, I think it is.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
It was wonderful. And then it had a double feature with Godzilla. Yeah.
Wow.
And I believe Criterion just put out a Godzilla collection.
Yeah.
So that is out. Nan, do you remember the last time you were at a drive-in?
Well, I wasn't allowed to go to the drive-in.
That's where the body movies were.
Right.
Too racy for the single screen.
But my...
It's her Amish heritage.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
We were talking about that earlier.
Yeah. My friend, Betty, her family went to the drive-in, and they had a station wagon, and they would
there
back
you go.
It up,
yep.
You know... And put down the
tailgate.
The tailgate and hook the thing up. And I have no idea what we saw because we really didn't pay attention. We were too busy talking and eating popcorn and
having
a great time.
That's good. That's good. Missy?
We actually took my kids quite a bit to Claremont before it shut down several years ago. So I would have to say one of the last ones I saw was probably Dodgeball.
Wow.
Oh.
You can dodge a wrench. You can dodge a ball. Thank you, Rip Torn. you hit Norman Mailer with a hammer and had a cameo in Dodgeball. Thank you. That's a good legacy to have. And the other one I should mention, I remember it was 1979. My dad took me to see the film called Heartland, with Conchata Farrell and Rip Torn.
Yes.
Two Hall of Fame first ballot that people. That guy, that lady. And she is a woman and her child that go to the Heartland in, I think, the 1890s. And she's supposed to work the field and winds up marrying Rip Torn's character. The film ends with the two of them birthing a calf, which blew my little 9-year-old mind. And my father leaned over to me and goes, they don't teach that in acting school. And because I hadn't fathomed that. Oh, they're going to do this. There's no birthing stunt doubles, and I don't think they could afford it. So that's what they did. So, yeah.
Birthing stunt doubles?
Well, if you...
I was trying to visualize that.
Well, here's a great example.
As a gynecologist and an OB guy, how would you do a birthing stunt double?
So you would film the actor grimacing and then someone else's and then cut to like a professional's hands doing it.
Oh, I see.
See,
yes.
That's
oh.
Right, but not this. No, Rip and Conchata, they get in there. They got in there and they did this.
Whoa.
Right. I don't feel so bad now. So
I think I have a new scene to put in.
That's right. Okay. Over at the Tibbs Drive-In. And we'll get to this. Screen one is Joker, which we'll get to in a moment. Screen two is The Kitchen. That's the crime 70s crime film with Elizabeth Moss and Melissa McCarthy. Screen two, you have the animated Addams Family along with Abominable. Two animated films for the kids. Screen three, you have Gemini Man and Rambo Last Blood. And four, you have Hustlers and It Chapter Two. Wow. That's a long night.
Yeah.
So that is at the Tibbs. At the Skyline in Shelbyville, you have Joker, of course. At 10:15, you have Candyman with Virginia Madsen and Tony Todd. And I believe Jordan Peele is remaking that film. And then Trick or Treat from 1986 at midnight. So that is happening over at the Skyline Theater in Shelbyville. We'll get to that. We mentioned Joker. And I think that's, there are other films opening, but there is still a lot of talk about the film. And as I saw it last Saturday, so I wasn't able to see it opening weekend. But as I was watching it, I think no matter what people feel about the film, that the Joaquin Phoenix performance is pretty damn good.
Yeah,
pretty stellar. And as I watched this and I was going through it and the little film critic, old man brain, started to kick in, and I started to think of, this has been quite often said in the art world, if you like something, it's an homage. If you don't like it, it's a ripoff. And I knew going in that there was going to be elements of Taxi Driver and The King of Comedy, which is a Robert De Niro, Martin Scorsese film I hold in high regard. I knew there was going to be some homages to that. I didn't realize it was going to be that much. And that kind of bummed me out a little bit. I still recommend the film for the performance, but... And I know younger folks are saying you're griping about a 36-year-old film, but as I told Missy, a 36-year-old film that's just as relevant today as it was when it was released in 1983. And Taxi Driver, we have had many films of an individual, usually a guy, going down a downward spiral. And that's what we get with Joker. And So I'm torn between that because it's one thing if it was a film 10 years ago or 5 years ago or if you're doing but on the flip side, we do in theater world, they're called revivals. They're not called remakes or restagings. Or every 10 years, the BBC and or PBS will do Shakespeare or Jane Austen or Charles Dickens. And that's and part of that, I believe, is how the adaptation is, because not every script of Little Women, not every script of Hamlet, not every script of Henry IV is the same. So and so since this isn't a remake, and I think the other part that I forgot this was a DC film, probably because it's not glossy and Zack Snyder's not involved, but it has a completely different feel to everything else. And so it's an origin story, but it just kind of pulled me out, me one individual. The film opened $90 million, so they can tell me I'm wrong for all I care. But there was so much of an homage to King of Comedy, and I told Missy, you wound up watching it per my recommendation. Did watching King of Comedy change your opinion of Joker?
No, I don't think it changed my opinion of Joker necessarily. King of Comedy, obviously there are very obvious parallels, but you know, even though King of Comedy is still relevant today, I think Joker pushed that even further because, you know.
With the results,
With the results, exactly.
I don't want to give away too much of that.
Right, because, you know, it reflects, Joker reflects more of what's going on in today's society with the actual, you know, with the violence and
right.
how, you know, people procure their objects to parlay that violence and, you know, and but I think with King of Comedy, he kind of kept to himself, the Robert De Niro character,
Rupert Pupkin,
he kept to himself. There wasn't a whole lot besides Sandra
Bernhardt, but it was also the bartender that he tries to impress and winds up pulling her in for a bit.
Right, but I mean, he kind of kept to himself, and people didn't really know that he had the psychological and problems that he did.
Just thought there was this kind of this goofy guy.
Yeah, whereas Joker, you see him, you know there's something wrong with that dude from the beginning, even before he gets really, really bad, before he really spirals. You know there's something going on because he had a job and he worked with people and everybody kind of knew.
The off-putting, yeah.
Yeah, there was something not quite right with this guy. And then, you know, it's what I see today is people are, they may not necessarily be reaching out because he wasn't reaching out for help. He thought he was all good to go. But if the people that were around him would take a minute to say, hey, is everything going okay with you? Is everything all right? Can I do something for you? You know, that's, I think that's where the disconnect is. We as a society don't want to deal with mental issues.
Right.
Mental illness and things like that. And I think that was where in Joker, I think it really shone the biggest spotlight was that, you know, we need to help because there's nowhere for these guys to go.
Right. And there is a moment, and it's doesn't really give away a whole lot, but he is assigned to go see counsel. And guess what, folks? Without really saying anything, funding or lack of it gets in the way. And I think what happens in the last quarter of the film, again, without giving away a whole lot, there's a lot, for me, there was a lot of stuff that was just kind of thrown to the wall. There's elements of Network. There's elements of The Purge. Mm-hmm. There's elements of going after the 1% as a target. As somebody who works in media, no producer would let that climax go that long. And that kind of pulled me out of it. Also, the fact that, and this makes reference to a film I saw last year that was an unpleasant experience. The film has the obvious songs that make sense, like Smile, Jimmy Durante's version of Smile. And then, yeah, there's a song by Cream that kind of shows up out of nowhere. There's also Gary Glitter Rock and Roll. And some folks got their knickers in a twist because Gary Glitter's going to get royalties over the use of this film, even though he's in prison for being a pedophile. But the non-ironic songs kind of pulled me out of it and almost felt like a fist-pumping support. Mm-hmm. And I make reference, I say that because last year's worst film of 2018 for me, the Bruce Willis remake of Death Wish, which...
Was it La La Land?
No, so Bruce doesn't sing in this one. Oh, that's his own sing. Oh, were we gonna go there, Macbeth? So we don't have enough time, and this is online to discuss that. So, but you know, when you're using AC/DC, like, yeah, we're not doing an anti-gun film at all, and that's not what Death Wish was. Even though you should watch the first Death Wish film with Charles Bronson, it wasn't a revenge film to begin with. So. Anyway, but that kind of pulled me out of that as well. So I think it's a flawed climax, but still circled, still anchored by a really, really strong performance by Joaquin
Phoenix.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely. You know, and I think the thing that most everybody is saying now is I heard it on the radio somewhere, it's holding up a mirror to society. And it really kind of is. I mean, because, mm-hmm. you know, the mental health issue is just out of control and unchecked. Things happen. Like,
let me ask something.
Please,
as a fan of comic books, the Joker has two aspects of him in the literature. One, you don't know anything about him, which is what makes him scary.
Right.
But the second thing is that although he obviously was murderous and obviously was deranged, he was very, very, very smart. He was not a dummy. Like that classic line from the Christopher Nolan movie, he says, "You're crazy." He says, no, I'm not.
Yeah.
You know, with it. And so I have not seen Joker, so I can't comment on it, but... from what I've seen in the review, it seemed to be more of a study of mental illness, and you don't get that aspect of the power of the Joker. Is you've got this maniacal guy who's also very, very, very smart.
I think this is pre Mastermind in his lifeline because.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, he's just trying to carve out a living in this mm-hmm. space and try
so
to find some happiness. Yeah,
scale.
Much smaller.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That's why there's reminiscent of Taxi Driver is there are moments where you're like, oh, well, maybe this will be the turnaround moment, and then no. And you're not so much rooting for him, but there is some human elements of, oh, maybe this will be the thing. No, it's not that.
Yeah.
In fact, one of my favorite things on Twitter was seeing... taking a first date to see Joker, and it's a photo of De Niro and Cybill Shepherd in their first date movie scene in Taxi Driver.
Oh, no.
And if you've not seen Taxi Driver, Travis Bickle not being the slickest operator takes the Cybill Shepherd character to a porn movie and thinks it's fine. And she's just squirming and really uncomfortable. So
I'm a big background watcher when I go to films. I
yes.
watch a lot of the background, so a lot of the marquees up.
Oh yeah,
that.
I love the marquees. I love you know if they just shot it on the fly, and you also know, oh, this studio put out that movie because one of their titles is up on the bill
right,
on the marquee
right,
there.
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. You know what I learned? You don't take not so much a first date, but when you're in the early stages of a relationship in college, Taxi Driver and A Clockwork Orange are red flags. However, I was coming from a cinematic standpoint, not the "this is my manifesto" guy. But, you know, 19-year-old idiot me didn't think that far. Yeah, explains a lot, doesn't it? So... yeah, we talked about my buddy Sean took a first date to Platoon because he was a big Oliver Stone fan,
oh,
and
no.
You know, because Salvador was amazing, and then I've since learned a little over doing such choices.
Oh, this is a fun topic, though. Okay, so Glenn, what was your first date with Colleen?
I took her to a place called Hippo Ice Cream, and. And we met in front of the university theater, and it was across the quad, and we went there.
No movie, just ice cream.
Do you remember the first date movie you had?
You know, I asked Colleen about that, and because you asked me that the other one of the other sessions we had here.
And what did she tell you?
And she couldn't quite remember. She thought it might be, what was that movie with? Deborah Winger and
an
officer
and a gentleman. Cowboy,
no,
Mike's Murder,
with Shirley.
Terms
McClain.
Of Endearment.
Yeah, she thought.
Wow,
it was that.
that's
yeah.
deep for
Ooh,
a first date too.
Man.
Yeah. She thought it was that, but and since I don't remember anything about the movie, I must have really enjoyed it. I tried to get her to go see a Godzilla movie, but she said no.
No,
yeah.
So
I have
much.
A better thing though. I told
yes.
you the story about the birth of our first son, Chris. We were married for about 7 years, and so we were used to being a couple and saying, you know, let's just go whenever we want to, just get up and go to the movie or whatever we want to do. And so the big hit movie that was out that summer was Aliens. It was the
James Cameron, 86.
And that was a huge movie, and I was very excited to go see it. And my son Chris was a couple of months old. And so I sat there and I said, well, you know, he's sleeping. We could just sit in the back row and it's fussy. We can get out and go. And she went along with it. And we get there, and of course the thunderous soundtrack comes up, and Chris immediately starts to cry, and she says, "Have a good time holding him in the lobby." Yeah. And I was out there for an hour.
Maybe if you took the kid to a Bergman film, yeah, it'd be a little, it wouldn't be as loud.
Yeah, exactly. So it was. So she always likes to tell that story. One of my many mistakes.
Yeah. Nan, first date film.
I think it was quite a while ago, but I think it was Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Oh,
okay,
that's a good choice.
All right,
I think
that's
so.
A good choice.
I, from my learning from my
yours
earlier
was Texas Chainsaw.
No, it was not Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Although I remember 1984. This was my parents would just give me $20 and say go see 2-3 movies because I think they wanted to be a couple. So, I wound up seeing Strange Brew. Not kidding, the film version of Hercules starring Lou Ferrigno.
Ooh,
I've seen that.
And yes, and ended with Texas Chainsaw Massacre because it was the 10th anniversary. Nice. Yeah, that's a 14-year-old boy's trifecta right
yes,
there.
Indeed.
Oh my God! But no, after the mistakes of previous times, although I did have a female pick. As a first date movie, the remake of Cape Fear.
That, with De Niro?
That didn't last long. But when I got to be with the lovely Mrs. Soucy, I'll have her pick. Ha-ha. And she picked the film version of To Jillian on Her 37th Birthday, which was a play that she knew of. And in the film, it's Peter Gallagher and his eyebrows as a widower. And his daughter is played by Claire Danes. His sister is Kathy Baker. And they go to the beach. And he's trying to move forward, but he's being constantly chatted with by the ghost of his wife, played by Michelle Pfeiffer, one of the most beautiful dead people on the planet. And my wife knew of my Michelle Pfeiffer appreciation. And she said, and I said, this is not going to bother you. And she goes, no, because the movie's going to be over 2 hours, and I'm still going to be sitting here. And she's a keeper. Now, however, in our courting days, because you want to please the other person, and this is important to them, and I made Mrs. Soucy watch Jackie Brown and Enter the Dragon. She had never seen blaxploitation or kung fu films or Hammer horror, and she's like, this acting's terrible. I went, yeah, but Christopher Lee's cool. No. And but there was also stuff that I call it the MasterCard logo, where there's her choices, there's my choices, and somewhere in the center. I also do that with Abdul, of all people. So Abdul and my wife, we have a really great solid center of pop culture.
He's mostly Disney princess movies, isn't he?
Yeah, that's it. You bring it up to him.
Yeah, I will.
See how that goes. Because Abdul has the game, you name the film, and he'll give you the racist conspiracy behind it.
Yeah.
So, for that.
Goodness, yeah. I just walked into that one.
Yeah, you did. But no, so we did a lot. So I always remember one of the first full Saturdays we had together, we went and saw IRT did a 90-minute student production of a Midsummer Night's Dream, which was fun. And then we had lunch. And then I dragged my now lovely wife to see Beavis and Butthead Do America.
Oh, my God.
And she said, am I the oldest one here? And I said, for what it's worth, I'm the second oldest. So, yeah. And then about after we got married, about a few months into the marriage, I was channel surfing and Foxy Brown came on. I'm a huge Pam Grier fan. And I said, honey, Foxy Brown's on. And she kind of leaned in and went, do I really need to watch this? No, I guess not. Okay. I'll be over here. And she goes, I know. So you kind of pick your battles in this case. So, all right. New on video. Here's another example of, I guess, I liked it, therefore it borrowed, but the dread-induced daylight horror film Midsummer is now out from the director of Hereditary.
My boys saw that. They liked it, but that kind of stuff just creeps me out.
I kind of want to see it.
Well,
I haven't seen it yet.
Are you a horror movie fan?
I love horror.
So, yeah, you got to watch this. Did you see Hereditary?
I did not.
Okay.
So that one first?
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. But this is set in where a group of Americans come to visit a kind of a hippie camp out in Scandinavia. Yeah. And as it as the film goes further and further, it's more of a cult. But and there's elements of the Wicker Man, the original Wicker Man, not the Nick Cage thing. But there's that element. And what this film, along with Hereditary, the filmmaker is great at giving you a long, drawn-out sense of dread. Not blood, not jump scares. There are some shocking moments in this, but just an overall feeling of dread. Hereditary was the film with Toni Collette that came out last year. Also, you'll feel better about you. Watch King Lear and Hereditary and enjoy Thanksgiving.
Don't watch Hereditary.
Yet. No,
the,
after.
The one you were describing is
not Midsummer.
It's Midsummer. Midsummer. So.
Because we're our Saturday night date night thing is science fiction slash horror slash.
Oh, really?
I'm gonna break.
Mine's the Great British Baking Show. I feel bad.
Mine's the Blues House Party.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're working.
That is working. Yeah, yeah. All right, I'm gonna break taboo. Not really taboo because I've mentioned it on the show before. Do you have MeTV?
MeTV.
Yes.
Just pictures of yourself around the house.
That is not.
Well, that,
yeah. That is not. Say, do you have cable or have you broken?
I have cable.
You should look up MeTV.
Yeah, it's a fun
MeTV. Okay. MeTV on Saturday nights is because part of it is, and then I'm going to name drop, but one of the stalemates of Saturday night programming on MeTV is a horror show host who goes by the name of Svengoolie.
Oh,
you've seen this.
My husband watches that.
Ah, very good. Very good.
I have not seen this.
Okay, you need to watch this if you're not listening to the Blues House Party. But but on Saturday, so it's Saturday nights. He is on. I'm scrolling now. We're doing hot scrolling action here on the film show. For instance, this is your Saturday night. They do westerns throughout the day. 6 o'clock, The Three Stooges. 7 o'clock, Wonder Woman. Linda. Oh, come on.
Linda Carter.
Linda Carter, really?
You don't like The Spin?
I love the spin.
But she's fantastic. She's beautiful. She's statuesque.
She is statuesque. I'll give her that.
Okay. Anyway, 8 o'clock, Svengoolie. Like, for instance, this Saturday night, the original Boris Karloff, The Mummy.
Okay.
10 o'clock, Star Trek. No. 11 o'clock, Buck
Not
Rogers
right
in the 25th Century.
Oh, Buck Rogers.
Gil Gerard. Aaron Gray.
No.
All right.
No.
Midnight, The Invaders.
Okay, maybe. Well, I don't know what that is, but it sounds promising.
1 a.m., Lost in Space. 2 a.m.
Danger, Will Robinson.
My fight inspiration, Dr. Smith. 2 a.m., Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, whatever creature is terrorizing the Robinson family, if it's green, they paint it orange, and it goes on Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. Thank you, Irwin Allen. Yeah. 3 a.m., Land of the Giants. 4 a.m., The Time Tunnel. That's your Saturday nights on MeTV.
When I was young, I used to really, really like to watch Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. And I remember when I was starting to get older and I was thinking about a career.
And you noticed the budget.
No, I was thinking about a career. I thought I might want to go to the military, and I thought I might want to be on submarines. That really a thing. So I got a chance as a young person to go and actually go inside a submarine. And you know what? They're not as big as these giant hallways.
And you're taller than
you can't just drive down the hallway.
Everybody's room looked big and spacious, and everything was like, this is cramped and awful.
And you're a tall man.
I know, you had to walk around
hunched over.
Oh, it was just like I couldn't.
You'd
believe
be that
this.
One stormtrooper that bonks his head on the table.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I couldn't believe how claustrophobic it was. And then they said, yes, and we stay underwater for 6 months at a time. I said, no, I'm not doing that.
Never mind.
I had a track coach that was in the military, and he had the thing of looking at your form and tell you what job you would have. And apparently I was a tunnel rat. And I went, no, I'm going to go to college. I'm okay. Thank you. Or in a tank. Went,
and then the other thing is I never could figure out, it was one of those crazy Irwin Allen type things. if you've ever done any scuba diving or any type of thing where you've been underwater, the color and the light disappears after about 50, 60 feet. It's just
not if you got a camera crew.
Well, but the windows were there, and you were like hundreds of feet underwater, and there's the giant squid. You could just see his all get out. There's no reason to have a window.
If you're Jacques Cousteau on the crew of the Calypso.
Or
Steve Zazu.
Yeah, exactly. And it was just really, and then it was always the same. Oh, and then the flying sub. Oh, my God, I love the flying sub. I love the flying stuff. It was the most unairworthy thing you could possibly think
yes.
of. And yet there they would do it.
Yeah. I enjoy the meatball sub.
Yeah.
Nan, look for MeTV.
Okay.
So, because it'll show everything from classic, like, you know, from The Mummy to Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy. It's the universal catalog.
Oh, I love that.
Host is Rich Coes, a.k.a. Ace Van Gulie, who's been on this program. And it's all, you know, bad jokes and shtick, and it's just a fun,
kind of
fun.
Like the last hour.
Yes.
Yes.
Last hour and a half.
Yes, yes.
And that reminds me, hopefully folks on on a very future close film sociology, if we can get him out of his schedule, we'll get Sammy Terry back on the show to talk about all things Indiana.
Oh, so. I would love to meet that man.
Really?
Oh, my gosh.
He's been on the show
I
a few times.
I am so impressed. He's, you know Sammy
I've had the pleasure of one of the when we did Titus Andronicus, I recorded him doing the curtain speech.
Oh, my gosh.
I'll play it for you later. Because there was our director, Josh. Hi, Josh. Loved horror movies. So we did a lot of homages to horror films while doing this particular production. And we figured if Sammy's doing the curtain speech, we set the tone. And
yes.
if you can't figure it out by now, can't help you. So... And then, he actually came out to see me, not in costume, but came out to see Dracula and enjoyed the scenery chewing I did on that
Just
thing.
Just tell me he's a nice man.
He's a great man. Now, this incarnation of Sammy has been on the show many times. I got to interview the original incarnation twice.
That's
cool.
Wait a minute. Okay, so this is not the original
son. Well, his son has taken over
gosh. You said that, I'm like, but he passed away some time
Look,
ago.
He has all kinds of imaginary friends.
Oh, well, yeah.
My imaginary, growing up, my imaginary friend name was Raquel.
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, yeah.
Explains a lot, yeah. No, as long as you believe him here and here, your head and your heart.
Yes.
So, no, when I first started at FYI, and I was involved with the then show, The Art of the Matter.
I loved that show.
Thank you. I got to interview Bob. That was my bucket list. I'm too old, too young to have a bucket list. But I really wanted to interview Bob Carter. And at that time, he was still doing like a one-off show on Channel 4, and he was doing appearances at Deer Creek and somebody else's maze and this and that. And word got out quick that Sammy Terry was coming to WFYI. So,
Bob Carter?
This was Bob.
I didn't know his real name.
Well, now you know.
Now I know.
Bob owned a music instrument shop here in town, and I've heard the famous stories that if you were there on the right day, he had there was a door behind his counter, which was his office, and occasionally if the door was left open, there was a coffin. And the other stories I have heard is sometimes a kid would go to get an instrument for camp or for band or whatever, and just as the kid was about to leave the door and the door was about to close, Bob would do the laugh. Right? Yeah, right? So word got out Sammy Terry was coming to the station, and I wait in the lobby, and there's other people. I'm like, don't you people have work to do? And he came, and I mean, everybody from maintenance to vice presidents wanted to meet this man. And they all said very much the same thing. You scared the crap out of me as a kid. And he loved it. Absolutely loved it. I got him in the studio because we were going to promote his appearances. And when I got him on the phone to set this up, he asked. He goes, do you want to interview me or do you want to interview Sammy? And I went, oh, sir, I would never ask you to do your bread and butter, but since you offered, can we do like a minute or so? And he's like, yeah, sure. So getting him from the lobby to the recording studio took a while because everybody wanted to say hello, and I finally got him in here. And I said to him, all right, we're going to talk. And we went over his entire career of television. And then I said, I told him, it'll sound like I'm wrapping things up. And then I realized you're trying to direct a television icon. He knows what he's doing. So I do the interview, and I do a very stagey, you know, well, Bob, thanks for, who turned out the lights? And then he did the laugh. And then I tried asking a few questions to Sammy, and he'd interrupt me by saying things like, why you look so scared, Matthew? And I think one time I actually said, I'm not scared. And, he did about four or five questions, and that was it. And at that time, we did somewhere, there's got to be tape of this. But for the holiday show, the Christmas show of The Art of the Matter, there was a period where we would ask local people, local folks of note, to read "Twas the Night Before Christmas," and I got Bob Carter to do it.
Oh,
as Sammy Terry?
No.
That would be fun.
That would, but no, I wanted because I'm like, well, that seemed like an obvious choice. So I said, no, just read it as Bob.
Yeah, yeah.
The last time, now when Abdul and I, always a great sentence to start with. When he was at 1490 and I was doing film reviews on his show, quite often if there was a guest, because Smiley's morning show was next door to us, quite often they would always have big time guests. And sometimes we would say, hey, can you bring them over here for a couple minutes? And that's how we got Johnny Witherspoon and David Alan Greer. And Bob was there. This was one of the last, I think one of his last go rounds. And we got him in studio for about 10 minutes. And, I remember that he had trouble getting in and out of chairs because he was a man of age. But I think we asked him one question and he just went. He knew exactly what to say and just went on. And it was fabulous. And he said his bit and he did the laugh and he was gone. And Sammy Terry had left the building. So anyway, Sammy, hope to get you back on the show very soon here
on
Film
Social.
This is you can go to Sammy Terry has a website for merchandise if you want to check that out and all of his appearances throughout Indiana. Now the big title that comes out on video this week, and I have grumbled to people in the studio. My love of sequels and how they're not really necessary. Most of them are not necessary, but they make them anyway. And I did not ask for a fourth one, but I wound up liking it. But Toy Story 4 is now out on video. And this time around, you have Bo Peep is back in the fold.
This time it is personal.
But yeah, Annie Potts is in here again, so that's very cool. And so, because I thought after the three, you had a nice, good trilogy, and Andy is older, and now we've gone to new kids. This felt like on paper, like a cash grab. Fortunately, they were able to find a different aspect to tell of what is a toy and what isn't, because the new girl goes to school, and she's scared and nervous, and she creates a doll. She creates Forky, that's voiced by Tony Hale. So there's that aspect on what is and what isn't a toy, as well as Woody has as a crossroads between meeting up with Bo Peep, who has now gone kind of rogue as an independent doll, and another adventure where you have to jump out of a moving vehicle toy size and get back. There is a couple things that did as a pop culture nerd make me crack up about this. The quote unquote antagonist of this film is a talking doll called Gabby Gabby, voiced by Christina Hendricks. Emma, my daughter rolled her eyes when I mentioned Christina Hendricks, but it looks like it looks like Talking Tina from the Twilight Zone. Yeah, that is exactly what it thought. And there's also little bitty elements to The Shining as far as this antique toy store. Yeah, there's a little bit, and the kids will just think it's a little scary and unsettling. And those of us old enough to go, oh my God, they did their homework.
I'll have to check it out.
Yeah,
that's the one we've seen all of them, but I wasn't getting a vibe off of this one, so I guess I'll have to rent it.
Yeah, it's worth renting. And there is Jordan. Yes, there is a Key and Peele reunion with Kiko Mike and Key and Jordan Peele as stuffed animals. The other one I didn't know was in this, and it's really fun. There is a. The character is Duke Kaboom. It looks like it's so not Evel Knievel. The wind-up motorcycle
Reeves,
thing.
Right?
Yeah, it's voiced by Keanu Reeves. And he's very Canadian. Very Canadian and very adventurous. And that's a lot of fun. And there's a couple climaxes that happen at the end of the film. And I did not cry at this one, but eyes were moist, more moist than usual. I will say that. It's Toy Story 2, the Jessie monologue, you know, and the use of the, I think, the Sarah McLachlan music, like it's an animal rights commercial. The end of three, and two is still better than three, and then this. So it's worth checking out. My fear is, and not really spoiler alert, if you're going to make a fifth one, I could see that one particular voice would really, really want to do a five because then they would be the focal point of it. Yeah. And that will feel like a cash grab and I will be crabby. So, but that's never stopped them. Who knows? But that is out on video. It's still worth checking out. Okay. With that in mind, I'm also catching up. I guess let me ask, when you are in rehearsal for something, can you watch something for fun? Can you watch something freely? I can't do that with reading. I can't read anything for fun because I feel like I should be concentrating on my script.
Yes.
Thank you.
I have to.
Yeah.
I have to get actually at this point I don't want to watch anything or read anything that could ever happen in real life or would ever engage my heart or make me cry or wring my withers.
I just moved a little farther away from that.
That's from Hamlet.
Yes, I know.
I don't want my withers wrung.
So you're going to watch Svengoolie then?
So I'm going to watch Svengoolie.
You're going to watch The Mummy.
I'm telling you, this week was bread week on Great British Baking Show.
I have watched the Great British Baking Show.
I love the tension over cupcakes.
Yes, I know. No.
And all they win is a plate. They just win a plate at the end. There's no money. There's no prize. You just get a plate.
I know. Yeah. But they are so intense. And that man who made the lime ginger pie. Have you seen that?
Oh yeah.
How you doing there over there, Missy?
Oh my gosh.
Good.
I'm sorry. We're having some fun over here. Sorry.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. It's all right.
It's getting close to dinner time. Okay.
All right. Are you able to watch stuff freely?
Between rehearsal and work, I get home from work and I really want to shut down. What I do when I shut down is I turn my TV on to either Big Bang Theory because I've seen every episode 12 times.
Right.
Or Law and Order because I can, those help me go to sleep.
Dun, dun,
dun. Yeah, dun, dun, dun. So, but, you know, as far as, yeah, I mean, we went to go see Joker last week and, you know, I watched Kim Comedy the other day because I had nothing better to do and...
Yeah. And I kind of told you to watch
it. And you kind of put that bug in my mind.
Well,
I could have gone with Taxi Driver because I kind of, you know, I wanted to go back and I want to see Falling Down again, too.
Oh, God.
I know.
I wrote a column about, I think it was, it was Defense and Hannibal Lecter having lunch and how they were misunderstood.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that's good. So, yeah. Okay. Well, there's a couple other sometimes if there's a special features on a disc, that will help me wind down. I'm currently going through both Jackie Chan Police Story films on Criterion. So a lot of Jackie Chan stunt work. And I'm like, oh, that's pretty good. I'll be laying down over here on the floor. but new on Film Movement is a film called Ulysses and Mona that I got to watch recently about a similar, it's not a May-September romance, it's a May-September friendship of a contemporary artist who's been in isolation, kind of self-imposed exile, and a 20-year-old art student who comes to be his apprentice. And what's interesting is that we see no art being created. It is about the friendship between the artist and the student, and what she brings to hopefully getting him to open up about his own what has happened with his own family and his own past. So there was some, I think it was on the box, it makes comparisons to the films of Sofia Coppola and Alexander Payne. It's not Lost in Translation. It's a little more low-key than that. Mm. So, but yeah, two good performances, French picture worth checking out. Ladies and gentlemen, there's a film called Guns, and this was sent to me courtesy of Mill Creek Entertainment. It is about a gun runner, an arms dealer, and he's trying to get rid of the federal agents that are on his tail. Now, that sounds like an exciting blockbuster story for you, but what if I told you the arms dealer was played by Eric Estrada?
Oh, my Lord.
And this is a film, directed and written by Andy Sedaris, a film that brags having, I believe, six Playboy Playmates in its cast because all federal agents look like models for Playboy and Playgirl.
Is that
And they
him?
Wear that.
Yeah. Well, there's that. Yeah, there's an obligatory hot tub scene. There's lots of love between the federal agents. And yes, if you want to see Eric Estrada emote, this is the film for you. Guns.
But wait a minute. That has to be from, like, the
80s. It is. 1990.
I'm pretty sure that Eric Estrada does not look like that anymore.
No, former...
I think he's dead.
No, he's not. he's still working. Okay. Former Muncie police officer on reality TV, Eric Estrada. But, yeah, this is out on Mill Creek Entertainment from Andy Sedaris.
Wow.
This is Film Sociology is your home for Andy Sedaris news. The man who gave us Malibu Express and Hard Ticket to Hawaii. And so if you like big guns and big girls and big explosions,
then come to Bartfest.
This, yes.
Come to Bartfest. At IndieBartfest.com.
No.
Big guns, big
less,
girls,
less
big explosions.
Less breast and no Eric Estrada.
That's
that
right.
Is Indie Bartfest. That's actually...
We have that, too.
That's Missy, actually...
And I think, I think Falstaff has a hot tub scene, doesn't he?
Possibly.
Yeah,
no,
that's
just me making soup. a couple other things. Also, if you get a chance on Netflix, there is a really cool... This is another one where you can say, is it an homage or a ripoff? But a film documentary called American Factory. And it's about a factory in Ohio that is hit hard times, and the town is briefly saved because a Japanese company comes in and takes
over.
Well, it's like Gung Ho, only real life. So it's that element, and the fact that, yes, it is true, they have jumping jacks and they do physical fitness rituals before going to work. The Americans are not up for that, but the clash of styles and the clash of work ethics happens. And there's actually a moment in this film where some of the American factory management go to the plant in Japan. And Glenn, this was an inspiration for having to wear my battle gear. When you tour the plant, they give you the little yellow Velcro reflector thing. One American guy was so large he couldn't strap it, so it's just kind of hanging and flying. That's my garb. That's my battle garb.
There you
So thank you to American Factory on Netflix for giving me that. But no, it's a really, really fascinating look at the American factory issues and the relations between the U.S. and Japan when it comes to work. And finally, we're going to wrap things up in a bit with a tribute to, I'm going to mention it, about drummer Ginger Baker, best known as the drummer for Cream and Blind Faith. And there was a documentary about him a few years ago called Beware of Mr. Baker, which it's a must-watch. Ginger Baker was a great musician, didn't need to spend time with him, didn't want to timeshare a condo with Ginger Baker, but it's him, warts and all, talking about his career.
This is the person on Gilligan's Island? That Ginger?
No.
You wish.
I'm sorry.
No, you wish it was about Tina Louise.
I'm
yeah.
sorry. Did I misunderstand?
I am man, hear me oink. No, so there.
Oh.
I was talking about myself, really.
I'm oinking in your powerhouse. Oh, it's going to be such a long bar test.
The man is, I believe it was Lainey Kazan who said, the man is the head of the household, the woman is the neck.
The neck?
Yes,
yes,
it turns everything. So, no, but as you're going to hear on the Blues House Party, if you tune in, the blues according to Ginger Baker. And I was thinking about, because there is a Cream song used in Joker that's a little distracting for my taste. And I was thinking of best uses of Cream, of the music of Cream in a film. The big obvious choice is the use of Sunshine of Your Love in Goodfellas. There's a great shot of De Niro smoking a cigarette, thinking about killing Morty and his wigs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably the most famous moment. I think I'm going to go online and post this and see what other opinions I'll get. But the one I always think of, there's a really underappreciated film from 1985 called Fandango.
Oh.
It's young Kevin Costner before he was capital K, capital C. Judd Nelson was the big star at the time. This was before The Breakfast Club, but after a film called Making the Grade. It's five college students in Austin in 1971. It's the weekend of graduation. They also, by Monday, they have to go register for the draft. And they're going to take one more road trip to Mexico. And it's directed by Kevin Reynolds way, way before Robin Hood and Waterworld and all this. He was a student of Spielberg's. And it's one of my favorite guy road trip films. For road trip films for the guys, it's Sideways and Fandango, and for the ladies, it's Thelma and Louise. But the beginning of the film is Costner dealing with his, we find out his ex-girlfriend is engaged to one of his friends, and the ex-girlfriend is played by a then unknown Susie Amos. And as he's throwing pictures at the photo of the two of them, he keeps hitting himself. And the song "Badge" by Cream is used underneath, and that's my favorite. And I wish Criterion would put out a special edition 2-disc set about this film. It's a wonderful, underappreciated. It's kind of pushed at times like a horny teenager movie in the ads, and it's way, way more than that. And also, at the end of the film, they use Blind Fate's "Can't Find My Way Home" in the closing credits, and it's a lovely use of that. So, anyway, Ginger Baker, salute, sir. So Glenn, where can people go for tickets and information?
That would be IndieBardFest.com.
That's right. So we start Thursday, and that's we right. run for 10 days.
Oh.
You clutched your pearls there.
Oh, I just clutched my rough.
Could Powerhouse get some smelling salts, please?
Yes.
Oh, that's so sad. Oh, look at that, Dan. Well, Missy, you're going to need to step up.
Yeah.
How do you know Lear?
Do you know? How about All About Eve?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Guys, thanks for hanging out.
Ah, it's a lot of fun. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. Oh, yeah, Heartland Film Festival is going on. So you can have great films and great theater all this week and next week. So go check out Heartland Film Festival when you're not at Indie Bard Fest. But thank you for listening. I want to end today's show with a tribute to Lolly Ramey, who was our longtime host of Classics by Request. She passed away this week. And this is a piece of Mozart, Symphony No. 25 in G minor. I know this because I saw the film Amadeus, and in about 1984 on MTV, somebody actually made a music video to this song where they incorporated clips of the film with clips of rock stars from Kiss to Madonna to the Rolling Stones. The whole, yes, Mozart was the original rock star angle. So, and I was just impressed for a brief period that you could hear classical music on MTV. So, Lolly, this goes out to you.